The most Taoist poem in American literature is by Wallace Stevens. Wallace Stevens, who was a very strange poet. He was the vice president of Hartford Accident and Indemnity Insurance Company. And he used to write his poems while commuting to the office. And he would write them in his mind. And when he got to the office, he would dictate to his executive secretary the poem of the day. So poets exist in the most unusual places. And American poets have had to exist in outrageously unusual places. This poem is one of Stevens' greatest. It's very short. It's called The Snowman. And this is American Tao. One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost and the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and to have been cold a long time, to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land, full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place for the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds, nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. The other poem is from Rilke, and I guess most of you know of Rilke, who believed that poets were the angels of the 20th century, and who was lucky enough when he was young to meet an extraordinary woman who had been a very close friend of Friedrich Nietzsche, Lou Salome. And Rilke at one time, when he was young, became Rodin's secretary, the great French sculptor, and watched the great man for several years in his studio, and became infected with the divine mission of trying to deliver mystical prophecies through high arcane poetry, and who died picking a rose in a garden for a lady, and the thorn from the rose stuck in his thumb, and it led to an infection and a blood infection, and he died. This is from the Sonnets to Orpheus, third of the first set. He wrote the Sonnets to Orpheus in about 1 week flat, never changed a word. He had gone for 10 years during the First World War, where he couldn't write a single line. Nothing would come out. And then all of a sudden, he was staying at a castle on the Adriatic, the Duino Castle. And he was alone in this enormous mansion and grounds, and all of the haunted, muffled spirits in him just came out, and he began writing the Duino elegies, finishing them up. And in the midst of that white hot heat of writing the Duino elegies, an even more intense spiritual possession came in, and right in the midst of writing them, he wrote the Sonnets to Orpheus. And this is the third of those sonnets. A god can do it, but tell me how a man can follow him through the narrow lyre. The human self is split. Where two heart ways cross, there is no temple to Apollo. Song, as you teach it, is not desire, not a wooing of something that's finally attained. Song is existence, easy for the god. But when do we exist? And when does he spend the earth and the stars on our being? When we love? That's what you think when you're young. Not so, though your voice forces open your mouth. Learn to forget how you sang. That fades. Real singing is a different kind of breath, a nothing breath, a ripple in the god, a wind. So there are two little pitch pipe cues to try and focus ourselves. Spiritual teaching is different from intellectualizing, and it's different from the kind of metaphysling that usually obtains. And usually what you need to keep in your orientation is that the images must vanish, and they must vanish in the right way. They must all be brought into the center so that in the implosion, the images begin to resemble one another because all the lines lead to convergence. And where they all vanish and come together, where all those lines of convergence come together, there's only a focus there, no point. And that focus, of its own nature, radiates. And that radiation is consciousness. Now, in our program, we start with nature because it's the only referent that we can trust. Any other beginning other than just nature, things as they are, as Lucretius once said, just simply begin with where we are. There are trees that grow, there's day and night, we're here, and other things are here, and somehow all of this has come to be. And we have to begin with that. Any other beginning leads to a skepticism which will deepen with a structural insight into nihilism, so that the only beginning that leads anywhere at all is nature. Now, there will be all kinds of convolutions, all kinds of revisions, there'll be some rejections, and there are some mysteries. But regardless of all the emendations that occur, we have to begin with nature. And so, like Dante's theory of poetry, no matter how complex the mind will grind, no matter how subtle the curve of the spirit, we have to begin with nature because it's the only basis for metaphors which will finally be able to be brought together. So that the peculiar quality of nature is that whatever nature is, it has hidden within it the quality of coming together, so that the development of the human self is a natural occurrence. The fact that we have a spiritual presence follows from nature. It is natural. But consciousness is not natural. Consciousness is supernatural. It's other than nature, but is related in a very peculiar way. And we'll find that consciousness parallels in an inverse way the natural process, which is always integration, always coming together. Nature, things in nature, tend not to be static so much, but to be elements in a mix, which is constantly evolving, constantly moving. So that we have seen that nature, instead of being regarded as a collection of things, is best to be thought of as a transformational medium. It is a flow. And what constellates out of that flow for us the first level of the real, actually are not things so much, but actions. What we do. And so in the next couple of weeks, we're going to make the first kind of change. We're going to precipitate out of nature the very first objective occurrences, which are not things, but actions. So that the ritual level occurs, it's like rain that comes out of nature. And what rains are actions, what we do. And so we'll see that nature, in a way, becomes parallel. That the movement of nature begins to be seen to assume a kind of a circle of nature, an ecology of its flow, which is paralleled by a circle of ritual. That whatever we do tends to assume also an ecological coherence to itself, so that each day tends to have a kind of a ritual structure. Each group of days, like a week, each longer period, like a lunar cycle, or like a month, or like a year, or like large years, 11 years for sun cycles, 56 years for larger lunar cycles, so that what we call time seems to aggregate itself in ritual, just as life seems to aggregate itself in nature. And we'll see that out of this juxtaposition of time and life, this paralleling of two kinds of circles, a wheel within a wheel, sets up a kind of a tension, a kind of a friction. And the wheel of ritual turning within the wheeled ecology of nature produces a kind of phenomenon which we call language. So that language begins as a smoke of the movement of action within nature, and finally gains a coherence when it flames into being. And so spoken language, we'll see, comes out of the juxtaposition of ritual and nature. Not quite in the way that traditionally was understood. And we'll see that the first indication is not so much that our sense of language has to do with naming objects, but of giving utterance to movement. So that the very first kind of ritual comportment that we have to attend to is movement. And natural movement becomes movement in ritual, which becomes something in dance. Now you can think in your imagination, ceremonial dancing and so forth. You can think, for instance, give you an example. In the Blackfoot Okan, there are different phases, the sun dance. There are different phases where natural movements, which are absolutely indispensable to the life of the Northern Plains Indian, are brought into the ceremony by having little ritual imitations. And one can understand that when one sees the Eats Kinaye, the Horn Society, dancing with the buffalo headdress and holding the large staffs that look rather like bishop's croziers, when you see them dancing and imitating the buffalo, you can see that this was extremely important to the mythic level of that culture. But later on, several days later, you see grown men going through the prairie chicken dance, and you think to yourself, All right, I could fit in the buffalo. That's important. Prairie chickens. They put a lot of feathers on their behinds and lift it as high as they can in the air and just go around like dumb clocks. And you think to yourself, what in the world? Till you realize that play is an essential of life, and you have to have that element too. And though you have the power of the Horn Society, without the play of the Prairie Chickens Society, it would be imbalanced. And so we'll see that there's a wholeness in ritual, which is taken from the wholeness in nature. Now, we're trying to make a transition, and we're taking a look at the way in which our books have set up a structure for us. Let's go back over that structure. When we started with Thoreau. We found that Thoreau is one of the most trustworthy of all human beings to just be with nature. Somebody who could stand in the forest and be a surveyor of snowstorms. Now, it's not so big a jump from Thoreau standing in the snowstorms in the woods outside of Concord to Wallace Stevens, the snowman. That's not so far. That's only about 80 years in time. And it's just actually one step in between the two of them. The step in between Thoreau being a surveyor of snowstorms and Wallace Stevens being a Taoist master is just the connection of Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman's cosmic person. So there's only one step in between them. But it's a big step. But we started with the portable Thoreau in order to give us a sense about how nature occurs for us. And for instance, we have here, here's a selection from Thoreau's journal. There are many words which are genuine and indigenous and have their root in our natures, not made by scholars and as well understood by the illiterate as others. There are also a great many words which are spurious and artificial and can only be used in a bad sense, since the thing they signify is not fair and substantial, such as the church, the judiciary, to impeach, etc., etc. Those who use them do not stand on solid ground. It is vain to try to preserve them by attaching other words to them, as the true church, etc. It's like towing a sinking ship with a canoe. Now, Thoreau writes this in his journal, January 1858. But it's an enormous issue. In fact, the whole Thursday lecture on Plato's dialogue, The Sophist, addresses this problem of language, which Thoreau, just in a off-the-cuff way, puts down in his journal. By 1858, incidentally, Thoreau was quite adequate. He made his own translations of Aeschylus and Pindar when he was just 20 years old. So he was quite somebody. And in 1858, some 30 years later, he was even more formidable. But in an offhanded way, Thoreau introduced all of the major themes of our whole two-year program without singling them out, without teasing them out as ideas. We settled for just reading Thoreau, reading some passages, and beginning there. In other words, we begin with nature, but we had to have somebody who would stand in for us in nature and be there, like being one end of a line of development. So that, in a way, we're going into a very complex kind of labyrinth. And Thoreau, for us, is the person at the very entrance of the labyrinth who is holding the end of the thread, which we, backing away from going into the labyrinth, will hold. Now, this is a mythic image. And the Greek word for that thread was clue. And our English word clue actually comes from the Greek in this sense. The Sanskrit word for the same phenomenon is sutra. So that, for instance, in the Buddhist tradition, one follows the Buddha's teaching. What was his teaching? It was always in the form of sutras, threads. Why? Because these threads of comprehension are like the little super strings of the structure of reality. And once you're able to know that reality responds to these threads of intuition and insight and understanding, you know then that the structure of reality is commensurate with the form of your approach to it. So that there's going to be a fit. Whatever reality is, it is such that this approach will be able to experience it, be able to realize it. Now this little thread, this clue that we're stringing out from Thoreau, where are we going? We're going to the center of the labyrinth. We're going to the deep self. And you can just trust that Thoreau will not let go of his imp. I have several books here published in India in the 1920s and 30s dedicated to the sage of North America, Henry David Thoreau. He's like a Upanishad master on that level. He will not let go of his end. So that at any time in the first year, if you get into a real quandary, you don't know where you're going or what's happening, you can always go back to the readings that we had in Thoreau and read for a little while, and he will refresh exactly where we started. In other words, there's an entrance to this whole complex. And no matter how delicate the filigree of the complex, there is only one entrance, and that's it. So that Thoreau is, for us, kind of like a secure father. He is also like an amulet, that he preserves the meaning of the beginning for us. He's always going to be there during this whole first year. As we moved from Thoreau, moved in, we realize that we're at the beginning of the labyrinth and that that's nature. But one of the qualities of nature, which we immediately became aware of, was that nature, whatever its mystical truth is, for us occurs in a structure. And its deepest structure, using a cue from Lao Tzu, is that it pairs. It's not only that there are two eyes or two halves to the brain, or left and right, or a day and night. Pairing is a universal structural phenomenon. The two. And the two occur because the one both is and is not. So that the deepest pairing of all is the pairing that Taoism preserves for us. Now the original archaic Chinese understanding was not quite so profound as all that. The original Chinese understanding was that there's this and there's its movement. Stillness and movement. But the stillness and movement are very good metaphors for what is and what isn't. And what isn't is because every time you look to see what it is, it's moved from that. In other words, its change is a movement away from the objectivity. So that the yin is receptive by virtue of its dynamic. And the yang is creative by virtue of its being there. So in an odd way, it's the yang that is stillness and the yin that is movement. And yet, in terms of this world, a conversion happens. It's like a photograph is printed and is there for us to see, but is printed from a negative. That the yang is still and the yin is dynamic, is in the negative. But the way it prints out in nature is that the yang is dynamic and the yin is receptively still. Notice that we found that there is a fundamental structural quality which occurs in nature, that nature is like a print out of something invisible, and that the structure in the invisible is just a mirror opposite of the way it occurs in nature. So that we see pairing occurs in nature in the printout, but pairing also then occurs in the invisible, in the negative. But that the negative in the printout, those two pairs somehow come together and make a whole. So that the fundamental quality of the real is a quaternary, a pair of pairs. Can you follow that? Is that too abstruse? In other words, you have to be able to see the nothing that is not there and the nothing that is. That's the real. So that nature for us, while it's a beginning, also, we have to be conscious of, is a truncated half-truth, half-lie. Nature is not the complete truth. Nature at its fundamental wholeness is only half the story. If you could understand all of nature perfectly, you would have exactly 50% of what is real. Now, in our time, the cosmological projection, because cosmology is the most potent synthesizing idea in our time, it has all the right projections. And one of the projections in contemporary cosmology is that there's dark matter in the universe which we cannot see, which makes up a great deal of the reality of the universe. It's a perfect projection. Just like the black hole is a perfect projection of the non-there self. In every age, the great synthesizing idea will always have the archetypal projections which are needed to bring out the questions that lead to wholeness. And in our time, cosmology is that. In fact, we could see that the thread that we're stringing from Thoreau to where we are going into this labyrinth, that thread for us is cosmology. That thread for us is a synthesizing idea, which is so dominant, so overpowering, that all of us as individuals, by the time that we have reached in our lives, are already enmeshed in the implications of that idea, already enmeshed in the labyrinth of activities and languages and integrations and differentiations that all come from that synthesizing idea being strung, as it were. So it's like that thread is not just a piece of mercerized cotton, but is capable of having vibration, of playing notes. So that there is a quality of resonance which occurs. So that synthesizing idea, we have to be conscious of. It is nature in our time for us, but it has a structure of resonance which we need to at least become aware of. And so, we began with two books, the I Ching and Origins, that the first resonance from the portable Thoreau was symbolically encapsulated by this pair of texts, Origins and the I Ching. Let's wait for the cassette to be changed. So now, watch how the picture changes here. Let's put this book, The Portable Thoreau, at one point. let's arrange these two books, the I Ching and Origins, on either side of it, so that we have, in the very first movement of our course, we've established a stable triangle. But notice that the triangle has a very specific structure. Two of the angles of the triangle are established as a resonance of the first point, the first angle. Now, in ancient Greek love of wisdom insight, this beginning angle was called the thesis. The thesis was a point of view that if you sighted along this point of view, what would you see? And by Plato's time, it was well understood that if you look in the most concentrated way of seeing along the thesis, you will eventually see five different kinds of shapes. And these are the archetypes of all structure, the five Platonic solids, which are incidentally are Pythagorean. It was Pythagoras who first had the mind enough to be able to see that this was how things were. That at the deepest structure, the way that things are, there is a five-phase presentation of their form in nature. That at the structural depth of nature, that's how it is. Now, the Chinese saw the same thing. The Chinese saw that an energy cycle always has five phases. And the ancient Greeks, before Aristotle, also saw that there was a five-phase structure. So that when it came to express movement, the early Greek and the classical Chinese are absolutely together as a parallel, that one could have moved between both cultures without any kind of discomfiture at all. One of the odd things that comes out of this, I have the five-volume set of A.B. Cook's great huge tome on Zeus, the mythological monograph of the god Zeus. And in the first volume, about a third of the way through, there's a whole series of engravings from 6th century B.C. Greek vases. And the positions, the movements of some dancers on those 6th century B.C. vases are exactly some of the movements in the Tai Chi sequence. Now, it's not like 6th century Greeks were studying Tai Chi in Attica, but that there was a similar understanding of structure and thus the way in which movement manifests itself. Because it's naive to think that this kind of waving of the hand is just an offhand movement. All movement has a very specific phase structure. We have, for instance, in the mid-1980s, discovered that even random motion, if looked at comprehensively in a really penetrating way, will exhibit an archetypal structure. Even random motion has an archetypal structure. It's incidentally the old infinity sign of the Hermetic tradition. That's the archetype of movement. Why would random motion form that kind of ecology? Because there are two attractors that occur archetypally whenever there's movement at all in any extended form. And it's like the two attractors in chaos theory. These two texts, the I Ching and Origins, are for us establishing the beginnings of the resonance of this thesis. Man in nature in a natural way to the deepest possible level. In other words, Thoreau was in nature as deep as somebody from the Upanishadic tradition would have been about 800 BC. He was able to stand in nature, transparent of any kind of cultural inflection whatsoever, and just be there and record exactly what it was. By June of 1840, Thoreau was capable of doing that. You can trace it in his journal, and you can see that by that summer, he was really somebody. This triangle, this triad, this trigram is a stable structure, but it has within its existence another triangle, which is invisible in this triangle, but nevertheless still there, thereby potent implication, that would manifest itself if we took this triangle and moved it forward. It's just like if you were in grade school, in the first grade, I think, they gave you little blocks to hit, little triangles to hit, and you made little percussion groups. I don't know if they still do that. They used to do that. If you strike a triangle, the vibration, it comes out triangular. And if one could see with an omniscient eye each vibration, if the triangle were made out of a self-consistent material, each vibration would be triangular in itself. The more real that the triangle was in terms of its continuity and flow, the more it would approach the quality of a soliton and vibrate wholeness, so that every aspect of the vibration would be itself the whole. In other words, this is a mystical insight which in the Hermetic tradition, absolutely indispensable to understand. When it came back to the surface in Western history, it came back at the time of the beginning of the 13th century, the early 1200s. And the person who brought it back into public view was the teacher of Roger Bacon. His name was Robert Grosseteste. He was the Chancellor of Oxford University at the time when Oxford first became a great university. And Grosseteste, which means great head, incidentally, said that when you look and see a rainbow in the sky, if you could look at a raindrop, a single raindrop in that rainbow, you would see the whole rainbow in that raindrop. In other words, the raindrop that occurs in the pink of the rainbow is not all pink. It has all rainbow in it. That's the basic insight. In the same way, he said to Roger Bacon, every human soul has the entire cosmos in it. You're not just a manipulable constituent that needs to be glued totalitarian style to millions of others in order for reality to occur. Every time that you are in your integrity, the entire universe occurs. So that the dignity and respect for the human person is founded on this level, this ethical insight and truth. So that when you dismiss a human being, you're dismissing a form of the cosmos. You can see that this is quite different from a cultural morality. This is founded on the molecular level of existence. Now for us, Thoreau was the thesis, was the beginning. The first vibration out of that was the I Ching in Origins, and the next vibration was an expansion of the I Ching to the Tao of Physics, and an expansion of Origins to Galaxies. So that by the time that we had got 5 weeks into the course, we had established this five form structure. It's like you can put the Tao of Physics outside of the I Ching, and you can put galaxies outside of Origins, and then put Thoreau right in the center. So if you strike thorough with your understanding, he vibrates, and the vibration produces these other texts. And if you could do a cross-section of that vibration, notice that what happens. You would come in to the outer half of the largest expression first. In this case, you would come to the Tao of Physics. Then you would come to the inner level, next, second, in this case the I Ching, and only in the third phase would you come to the center, that is in fact the center, but it occurs third in the series. And then going further, one would come back out in origins to that first vibration, and then fifth, last one would come back to where one had already begun, going into the center and come back out. So if you put it in a linear fashion, it occurs in a mysterious way. The center does not occur first, but occurs centrally in the third of the five phases. So that the old Chinese Taoist way of explaining this was to say that the Tao is the first, and out of the Tao comes the one being the first vibration. So that one moves to the Tao, to the One. So that the Tao cannot be one. So that the Chinese made the Tao a Wu Wei, a zero. Now they didn't have the notation for zero, but they certainly had the insight of Wu Wei, a nothing in itself. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, it means that it's more profound than existence. It's the base out of which existence precipitates, the invisible base out of which visible unity precipitates. So one moves zero, one, and then the third stage is the two. And to Chinese Taoism, that's where man occurs. He occurs at the two. He occurs at this pairing. Now, if you freeze a pairing, you have duality. And you have to understand that that's a kind of a sophomoric ignorance. To be haunted by dualism is to be like the pool shark who's afraid to take the next shot because he might miss. You're already in the game. It's stupid to quit shooting because you might miss. So dualism is like a fool's kind of ignorance. It's pairingness, which is true. So that to the Chinese, the Tao, then the unity, then the two, and that's where man is, and then the three. Because notice that the next vibration here is just part B of the first circle. So that the one and the three are related together. The one and the three occur simultaneously as a pair. So that when one is going to express unity, one can use a trinity to express unity and not lose a beat in speaking accurately. That is very, very, very esoteric. If you struggle with it, it's extremely simple if you just go with it. And you don't have to go to some extended theological explanation like Saint Augustine, who understood when he was younger in a Manichaean way and misunderstood when he was older because of the domination of his mother in a Christian way. It has instantly nothing to do with Christianity. It has everything to do with being mother-ridden. You don't have to go to a St. Augustine to try and understand why Trinity can act in place of unity. You can just take this little Taoist diagram that I'm making for you and understand. Should we pause here for a second?